coming up on Garden Talk.
It's just basically touching the top of the soil. And what that will do is that will incorporate all those amendments. It'll get rid of all those weed seeds that have germinated. And it also will allow us to have soil contact with our Korean natural farming input. The soil health that we have on the farm, indigenous microorganisms or IMO, is our very best friend. People are buying all these bottles of microbes. We call them bugs in a jug. And that's great, but it's very limited diversity. Out in nature, you can pick up a teaspoon of soil, and within that teaspoon of soil, there are literally thousands of different species of microbiology. Korean natural farming has that microbiology diversity. That diversity of soil biology allows those plants to uptake nutrients that are harder to get normally. That allows it for it to be a stronger, healthier plant.
What's up, everybody? If you that don't know me, my name is Chris, aka Mr. Grow It, and you're tuned into the Garden Talk podcast. This episode number 90. In this episode, I interview Wendy Kornberg of Sunibis. She has been gardening all her life and is a licensed cultivator in Humboldt County. She does low-till farming and also a lot of natural farming techniques. She talks about low-till farming and how it differs from no-till farming, as well as other techniques that she does on her farm. If you gain value from these podcast episodes, please click the thumbs up and subscribe to the channel if you haven't already. That way you can be notified when new episodes are released. If you'd like to support even more, visit patreon.com/MrGrowIt. There are various rewards set up for those of you who support, and you can pledge any amount that you'd like. 100% of the money that gets pledged through Patreon goes right back into the podcast. It really helps the podcast keep going, so thank you so much to those of you who support. Before we get into it, I want to acknowledge that one of my goals for this podcast is to provide free information about gardening all plants to the general public. That being said, I'd like to thank the sponsors of today's episode who helped make that goal possible. Thanks to Grow Strong Industries for sponsoring this episode. They have Gorilla Grow Tents, which I've used for many years. They are well known for their thickness, durability, and height-adjusting roof. They also sell Super Closet products, which consist of grow boxes, grow cabinets, grow tent kits, and hydroponic systems. To see their products in action, check out their first ever Grow Strong Grow-Off. Go to their website, growstrongindustries.com, linked below, and use the discount code MrGrowIt for 15% off. AC Infinity is sponsoring this episode. My entire ventilation system is AC Infinity. I have their inline fan, ducting, and carbon filter. I love the controller, with the temperature and humidity programming, and having control of different fan speeds. This makes it so much easier to control my grow environment, and I can't wait for the controller 69 Wi-Fi version, which also controls their oscillating fans and grow lights. You can use discount code MrGrowIt for any of their products on their website, acinfinity.com, or use discount code MrGrowIt15 if you're buying off Amazon. And we are back. Welcome to the Garden Talk podcast. Today I am joined with Wendy Kornberg of Sunibis. How are you doing today?
Doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. Today we're going to get into low-till farming. A lot of people have heard of no-till farming. Low-till, something kind of new here, right? It seems like more and more growers are going towards no-till, but low-till, something that you're going to give us the rundown on because you have experience on it. And so in this episode, I like to get into kind of what you do in your garden, on your farm. But first, what I want to do, which I do with all guests, is an introduction. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into gardening?
Yeah, my name is Wendy Kornberg, and I run Sunibis, Humboldt's Full Sun Farms. We are a small family farm that grows mostly medicinal plants on the banks of the Eel River in southern Humboldt County in California. And I basically grew up gardening. I don't really remember a time in my life that I haven't had something growing. I did find when I went to college and lived in an apartment for a while that I'm not the best at growing plants like house plants. I managed to kill a fern. I managed to kill a ficus. It's like the plants that you're, you know, supposedly not able to kill. And then I got orchids and found out that those work very well for me because I think I was killing them literally with kindness. I was paying too much attention to the plants, and orchids are supposed to die after they bloom, or so I was told. So I had bought some and just like they bloomed, they're beautiful. And then I ignored them and they didn't die. And I went, oh, maybe this is my key. But yeah, other than that, basically my family growing up, my mother had about a 1 acre garden, including orchard trees and some grapevines and things like that. So that was always what I considered, you know, a garden is a decent amount of square footage. And that was all subsistence food for our family for the winter. So my mom would grow a lot of tomatoes and, you know, do a bunch of canning of spaghetti sauce and tomato sauces and things like that. We often dried fruit. So we would have like dried apples and things for through the winter. Potatoes, you know, we had a root cellar. So potatoes, onions, like all that stuff, canned peaches, basically you name it, we would try and grow it and figure out how to save it over the winter.
Awesome. So gardening all your life, lots and lots of experience. So 18 years of gardening, right? That's all your life?
Yeah. Yeah. 20 now. You know, I didn't garden when I was two, but yeah, yeah.
So no-till gardening. A lot of people know what that is, but I have a lot of beginners on that listen to this podcast, a lot of beginners and intermediate. So there's some people that might not know what no-till is. Can you talk to us about what no-till is and also what low-till is and kind of the differences between the two?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to preface this, like we tilled my whole life. My mom every year would wait for my dad to get the huge BCS rototiller that was always kind of on its last legs. And oh, I remember as a kid, it was so loud. So she would spread a lot of chicken manure and some other soil amendments. I think we usually used oyster shell, a little bit of green sand, maybe some Calfos or Softfos or something along those lines. And then my dad would come through with the BCS and just, you know, till through all the beds, multiple passes, and my mom would plant. And that was the kind of the way that I learned how to garden. But as I started gardening and farming on my own, I quickly realized that like tillage is actually, I didn't have a rototiller, so I had to rent one. They're expensive where I live. They're loud, they're obnoxious. I'm 5'2" and weighed at the time when I started about 120 pounds. So trying to mangle one of those beasts into doing what I wanted it to do was always a challenge. So we started looking into no-till, which means you literally do not till the soil. And in a lot of ways, it's really, really great. We also utilize Korean natural farming, which benefits from no-till. The problem we came into over and over again is that, number one, if you let your soil lay fallow or get bare at any point in time where you're not cultivating crops on it, our soil gets very hard and compact very quickly. The rain will literally pound the soil into like a cement brick. And at that point, in order to break that up again, you can do things like broad forking, which is basically a big, huge, like imagine a giant fork that you pound into the ground and then you lean back until your soil cracks open. And it's a way to protect the microbiology and protect your soil. But unfortunately, the soil would be so hard. I literally couldn't even get a broad fork into it. I'd be jumping up and down on it and falling over. And it just wasn't working for us. So that is an option that is a no-till situation. You can do no-till lasagna bed methods, which is really cool as well if you've got a small square footage. So you can utilize cardboard, which smothers the weeds. It suppresses any weed germination. Okay, and then you can put compost and soil and things on top of that and then mulch on top of that, and you can plant in that. And it's a great way to garden. I've done that in small scale. So, you know, utilizing maybe those beds are 3 feet by 20 feet. I could do that easily on my own, but it does take a lot of cardboard. It does take some time and energy. And inevitably, because I live out in the country, we have weed seeds that are constantly blowing back in. So I'd have to redo it basically every year to smother those weeds out. So that wasn't working very well for us. Cover crop is great to try and suppress the weeds, but inevitably, you know, our farm is 18,000 square feet of medicinal plants, as well as another 2,000 currently for vegetable crops just on the farm itself. We'll be expanding that out. We were trying to expand it this year, but we just didn't have the time and manpower. You know, looking at basically a half an acre to 3/4 of an acre, hopefully up to an acre by next year of total cultivated square footage. But that's run by myself, my fiance, James, and my mom, who is 73 years old, and we have 5 kids. So it's a lot to work with just a very, very small amount of people. We've definitely been trying to get people on board. We have a lot of people that come and volunteer for a few days here and there. But when you hit those crunch times of it's time to get the soil prepped and it's time to get planted, we quickly find that we usually run out of time. So what we've turned to that works for us is a low till situation. So generally when you're using a tiller, what you're doing is you're actually cultivating the soil, you're turning it and you're grinding it up, and you're doing that at some pretty deep levels. Most tillage recommends like 12 to 18 inches, if not deeper. That way you get a really good bed of really soft soil that your plants don't have to work to get their roots through. The problem with this is all the microbiology that exists in that soil, and hopefully you're working with soil and not dead dirt, so hopefully you have a lot of biology in there. It gets turned up to the surface and it gets mangled and pulverized, and what ends up happening is it dies. And as that microbiology dies, number one, you're losing diversity of microbiology in your soil, which means that you're losing plant health inevitably, or you're having to replace it. A lot of times people are buying all these bottles of microbes, we call them bugs in a jug, and that's great, but it's very limited diversity. Out in nature, you can pick up a teaspoon of soil, and within that teaspoon of soil, there are literally thousands of different species of microbiology. The best jugs I've come across have between 20 and 40 species. It's just, it's not the same thing at all. So if you've tilled appropriately, you've turned all your microbiology up to the surface, they've died back, and the real detriment to this is they have now actually created carbon dioxide. So a lot of the carbon dioxide that we deal with nowadays is not coming from driving or flying or producing tires or things like that. A lot of it is actually industrial tillage of commercial cultivation of food. So it's not a great practice on a lot of levels. But what do you do when you have something that's like, okay, I have an acre that I'm running. I don't have an acre worth of cardboard. I don't like silage tarps and it's not working for me because weed seeds are blowing in every single time of the year. And if it's not dandelions in the spring, then it's foxtails in the summer. And then it's lamb's quarter in the fall. And what do I do? What we've turned to is what we call low till. So that means that we're not tilling deep. We're not going 12 inches. We're not going 18 inches. We're literally just tilting the top inch or two of the soil. This allows us to get our nutrients in easier. So if we're using something like compost or chicken manure, or if we want to put out some rock dust, we can actually incorporate that into the top layer of the soil gently. It loosens that soil bed so that our seed bed is nice and soft so that our plants are easy to transplant. If we're transplanting, our seeds are able to germinate and take root easily if we're germinating seeds. And it also allows us to cultivate the weed seeds that have germinated and get them to basically be tilled back under, but without actually tilling and really disturbing the soil. That was a rather long explanation of the differences, but you know, they're varied and vast, and that actually was a short version.
No, it's really, really good to have that amount of detail. I appreciate that. So is it the same piece of equipment you're using for low till?
We actually purchased a Kubota tractor last year. And the main reason I wanted the tractor was so I could do large scale indigenous microorganism piles, which is a Korean natural farming methodology. But as we went through, it turned out that we're like, oh, wow, like, go figure, farmers really need tractors. They're very, very useful for a lot of things. We used it for putting rock out on the road. And through that system, I was like, you know, yes, I can rent that BCS rototiller from my local shop that rents out equipment. But that thing costs, I think, like $60 a day. We usually need it for at least a week. We're going to need it a couple times a year, and we can't do things like move rock around with it. So with the Kubota tractor, what we can do is we don't actually have it yet, but we're working on getting a couple of attachments on the back. One of them will be a rototiller attachment. And they also make, They make a lot of different equipment for tractors, actually. It's kind of amazing. If I had my choice, I would probably get something that is, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but there are ones that actually will fold the soil over rather than tilling. And so it's like I know there are different companies, not Kubota specifically, that make, they're called bio somethings. My friend Sunshine knows. And those, the reason why we would like that equipment at some point is because we are planning on doing a dry farm. So dry farms are farms that have no irrigation. And people are like, how do you grow things without water? And it's actually just a completely different methodology. What you're doing is you're keeping, there's no cover crop, there's no companion plants. Well, you cover crop in the winter, but there's no companion plants. There's nothing growing except for your cash crops in your soil. And what happens is you end up with like a dust mulch layer. So there's a layer on the top that's hot and dry. And as that gets hot, the way water wicks, the way it transpires, the way it moves in soil, if you have the right soil texture, that's key, which we happen to have. So that top layer will dry, it will get hot. The cool water from below will be wicked upwards towards the plants. And what you end up with is a little layer of hot, dry soil and then a layer of really moist, beautiful, rich soil underneath. So this tuner tiller, it's ta-ta, it starts with a T, I can't remember. Whatever this thing is called, bioturner maybe, something like that. What it does is it protects your biology and it just literally flips your soil around. So it loosens it, it aerates it a little bit, but it doesn't actually till it up. So we do want one of those. And then for the farmland that is irrigated, that thing doesn't work as well, to my understanding. And so what we'll do is have the rototiller attachment on the back of the tractor that we're just going to set your depth. So instead of setting it all the way down where it's tilling 18 inches or so, you just set it so it's just basically just touching the top of the soil. And what that will do is that will incorporate all those amendments. It'll get rid of all those weed seeds that have germinated. And it also will allow us to have soil contact with our Korean natural farming inputs. So indigenous microorganisms need to actually contact the soil. So if you're just spraying it on top of grasses and things, you have it does, it still works. It's just a more limited efficacy than if you can actually have contact with the soil itself. Then of course we will be, well, I guess I shouldn't say of course, because a lot of people don't do this, but then we'll be mulching on top of that, and then the plants go into the soil through the mulch.
Got it. I imagine for the folks that are tuning in that are more of a small scale, like I have a lot of home growers that grow indoors or they have small outdoor gardens. If they were to implement low till, they could probably just use a small hand rake, for example, and dig down an inch or two. And I imagine a lot of people doing that when they're top dressing in organic amendments. Is their top dressing, but using a small little rake or something, or using their hands to mix things up on the top. So it's kind of similar to doing that, huh?
Yeah, it's basically like scratching it into the top of the soil there. It works out really well. A lot of times with home growers and with people that are, have indoor gardens, it's a little different because you're not working with living soil so much. There's so many people that are like, but I have worms. And I'm like, and worms are amazing and they're awesome. It's not necessarily an indicator that you have a functional soil food web. True living soil is a system that is self-sustaining. That means that you're not adding microbial activity, microbiology every single week. Anytime I see a bottle of microbes that says you need to add this with every watering, my brain goes, okay, but why? Because biology works in the same way that all life works, right? Is that it replicates, be it through asexual or sexual replication, it doesn't matter. It should be doing that. So if it's not doing that, there's something wrong with its environment. And if there's something wrong with its environment, you're having to keep adding new populations all the time. And this to me just doesn't make sense. Like out there in nature, nobody's going out there and adding Bacillus species to the forest every single week, right? So if you're trying to get a biologically active soil, your big takeaway here is you're not going to do it with potting soil. You're not going to do it with a soilless medium. And most potting soil is pretty junky. Most compost that you buy commercially is pretty junky. Like municipal compost is full of pesticides and herbicides because there's no check and balance. Anybody who wants to put green waste into a municipal composting facility, they just send their green waste off, and you have no recourse on or no knowledge even of what was put on those plants before they went into that facility. Most composting facilities don't use biology, they just use heat and pressure and turning and oxygenation, which is great for breaking down material, but truthfully, it doesn't mitigate anything that's in there. So if there's poisons or herbicides or even excess fertilizer, it's not really getting broken down in that composting process. Now, when you start adding biology, it's a whole different world. There are amazing studies that I read all the time about how different fungal species and different bacterial species have the ability to actually mitigate things like, you know, oil spills. We've heard about that for years, right? There's ones now that are showing that they're mitigating heavy metals. So toxic heavy metals like cadmium and arsenic are a lot of problem in a lot of native soils. What do you do about it? Well, if you have an extremely diverse microbiological population that has lots of fungi, lots of bacteria, lots of, you know, amoeba and nematodes and everything you need to show that you have a functional soil food web, you're going to probably or possibly, I don't know, you know, there's the jury's still out on that one, what the probability is. But there's a good likelihood that you have something that can actually start mitigating those heavy metals, and they'll tie it up in their body, or they'll chelate it and actually make it into a compound that's not a bioavailable to the plants. It's just cool, 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 amazing stuff. And again, that has more to do with people that are growing outside in native soil than people that are inside. But even for people that are inside, they're like, well, I mean, I don't want to bring the outside inside. Like, I have this nice sterile environment that I think I'm, you know, able to kind of keep in its little bubble. And again, it's not really the way plants grow. You know, you have a limited cycle with your potting soil inside. You know, we used to grow inside back in the day in Humboldt County a lot. And we basically, at some point, the norm became to take out your dirt every time you planted a new plant. So you'd remove all your soil and you bring in all new bags of soil. And at some point I was just like, okay, this is silly. This feels really silly to me. Like, my garden loved it because it got fresh topsoil or fresh potting soil all the time, made my heavy clay much more aerated and light. But I was like, you know, I'm tired of doing all this work. We're going to do something different. We're just going to reuse our soil. So we'll just add compost and some amendments like we would outside, and we'll just see how that goes. And it worked really well for a while. And then what I found was that, and we actually moved into beds, and we did bring in a little tiny rototiller, like a little mantis thing. So you'd like, ring, and you'd turn everything around and you'd till it up. And what we found is that pretty soon your soil texture turns into dust. It turns into garbage. You lose all the good texture that's in that soil. It gets really compacted. Plants start getting really unhappy. And I was like, huh. Okay, so potting soil is not like regular outside soil. This is, when you look at it, it's pretty obvious. But, you know, experientially, especially as a young person that was growing up doing a lot of gardening and a lot of farming of medicinal plants that aren't, you know, widely talked about, or that weren't widely talked about at the time, it was like you didn't really know what you were doing wrong. You were just experiencing things and realizing that, like, oh, after, you know, doing this 4 or 5 times, it's not working anymore. So why would that be? What's different from outside? And, you know, kind of looking back and forth and being like, ah, you know, different organic matter, different starting material. And so then we started incorporating native soil back in. So we'd actually go and dig buckets up out of the garden and bring those inside, and realized very quickly that you could actually kind of rehabilitate that potting soil, if you will. Like, we'd bring in wood chips and duff from the forest, and, you know, different. We started mulching. We weren't mulching at the time. We didn't mulch inside because, I don't know, why would you? I didn't really know what I was, you know. Soil science wasn't such a thing when I was in my, like, you know, early 20s. Or maybe it wasn't, I just didn't know about it. Maybe I wasn't such a soil nerd. That's very possible. But we started mulching, so we were protecting that layer of our soil. And then as we would, you know, gently turn it in on the next round, it added organic material to the soil itself, which added to the soil structure. You know, looking back on it now, I'm like, man, I wish I had somebody like me to tell me how to do it, you know, back then, rather than doing all of this trial and error over years and years of being like, why is this so different? I don't understand. And why are we having so many pest issues? Like, I don't have problems like this outside. Why do I have this inside? I know it's more protected, but still, there's got to be more to it than this.
We have certainly come a long way, and things are a lot easier now with the knowledge we have today versus 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and so on and so forth. It's incredible the amount of knowledge that is circling around there in the community, and people are implementing in their gardens today. It's wild. So going back to low till, so you've low tilled your soil. Are you doing anything else to prepare for planting? Like some people add in amendments or compost. Some people will plant a cover crop and then grow their plants with it. Are you doing anything else preparing the soil for planting?
Yes. So we basically want to have something growing in our soil at all times. Ideally, it's not our native grasses because they seed readily and frequently, and they have deep roots and they're just really difficult. They outgrow everything. They're difficult to deal with. So, in the winter time, we missed our little window. We just had some rain up here. So I was trying to get out to actually do our cover crop in the areas that we have already, harvested, but we didn't quite get to that. We've done living mulch at different times. This year, we really like to have mulch on our soil. So it's the easiest way for people to kind of keep soil covered and not have to worry about cultivating or taking care of something or, you know, weeding all the time. If you just do a super heavy, thick layer of mulch alfalfa, organic alfalfa is really the jam. It is amazing. You'll actually see the residual benefits the next year of that organic alfalfa. Unfortunately, organic alfalfa is apparently next to impossible to find. So if you are trying to mulch 18,000 square feet with organic alfalfa, you need these very, very large bales. They weigh about 500 pounds, and we usually use about about 10 to 12 of them per year. And we couldn't get any this year. There was none to be had. I mean, I was calling from California, I was calling Arizona, I was calling Nevada, I was calling Oregon, Washington, up into Idaho, and I couldn't find anybody that had organic alfalfa available for purchase. They were all have been contracted out. So something's going on with like the dairy industry, I guess, or animal husbandry, that people are really moving towards needing that organic alfalfa for animal feed. So it's not available for farmers like me to use for mulch. So this year we tried living mulch, which is basically a short growing plant that grows underneath your cash crop, and it keeps your soil from being bare. So we had limited success with that. Part of the problem was by the time I gave up on finding alfalfa, we were well into summertime. So all the seed that we put out didn't germinate very well because it was too hot and dry already. So, you know, we've had years where it's very successful, and we've had years like this where it wasn't. So luckily, in a way, we don't have to worry about a living mulch that we have to contend with trying to save. I've had years where literally would dig it up and move it out of the way, because once you add cover crop, that generally grows tall and high, and you have to cut it down. So if you're growing cover crop and you're chopping it down, your living mulch is now being smothered out. So if you're going to have living mulch and cover crop, you're going to have to remove your living mulch. And my living mulches generally don't overwinter. They die back. I'm back at that problem of having bare soil again. So we will, as soon as we can, plant a cover crop. My preferred cover crop is a mixture of legumes, so different peas and like fava beans and things like that, and some vetch. There is a lot of like winter rye that people add and grasses. For us, I'm not a huge fan of the grasses as much. We don't need to break up any compaction layers. So some of those grasses have really, really deep roots. They're really good for heavy, thick soil. But our soil has been cultivated now for, I think the most recent garden is running on 8 years now. Oh gosh, maybe more than that. Somewhere around in that range. And then the oldest garden is about 15 years of that same soil being taken care of and being built every year. So it's got beautiful texture. It's nice and loose. We do amend every year. We did not send out for soil tests this year, but I do recommend you do test your soil just so you kind of have an idea of baseline of what's there, what kind of macronutrients are available or present, what kind of micronutrients are present. And that can help you just kind of decide what you want to amend with, if you want to amend. I'm going to go against the grain of what people are frequently told. If you pay any attention to people like Dr. Elaine Ingham and a lot of the wonderful regenerative scientists and people that advocate for regenerative agriculture, they're all phenomenal and I love them to death. I think they're amazing and super smart, but experientially, I have not had the experience that they say, which is that everything that you need in the soil is present in the soil. That has not been what I've noticed at all. We are generally very nitrogen deficient if we don't add nitrogen to our soil, or else I'm having to constantly feed my plants all the time. And I'd rather put it in at the beginning and have it be there in the soil so that the plants have access to it when they need it, rather than me dictating when I think the plant needs it. Usually by the time I notice a deficiency, even if it's super early on, the plant is like, yeah, I've been starving for like 2 weeks. Thanks for finally feeding me. So if I make sure it's there in the soil, then I don't have to worry about that. I can take that kind of off my plate and not have it be a concern. I think one of the main things that gets kind of missed is certain crops, especially our medicinal herbs, we're removing the entire plant. We're not just removing the fruit. So if you have a tomato and you're just taking the tomato fruit off, you're removing that nutrient. All the nutrients and minerals that it took to make that fruit have disappeared. But if you leave the plant itself, all of the leaves will decay, your vines will decay, they'll add to your soil, and anything that that plant utilized from the soil will be returned to the soil. But if you have a medicinal plant and you're taking the whole thing out, you're removing all the nutrients that that plant accumulated over the course of its life from the soil. That means you're going to have to replace it. So for us, again, nitrogen's the big one. We prefer organic manures. We prefer organic alfalfa meal when I can find it. Some crustacean meals and things are really, really great. And then we usually do rock dust every year. Ideally, I'd like to get enough rock dust to do it once every 20 years, but that would be like a lot of rock dust. Rock dust has all of your trace minerals and micronutrients, not all of, but most of your trace minerals and micronutrients that your plants need. We usually do some oyster shell that adds to our calcium, which tends to get depleted rather rapidly with the crops that we farm. And earthworm castings. If you're working with fallow soil or native soil that hasn't ever been utilized before, as many earthworm castings as you can afford is great. It adds biology instantly. Once you're getting rolling, you don't need to add as much, or you don't need to add as much every year. You can kind of go, you know, one year on, one year off type of thing. What else do we put in there? I think that's kind of the majority of it. And then we do Korean natural farming. So that's really our big ticket item. So our, you know, do this one thing to get the most out of it is going to be indigenous microorganisms. So I've mentioned that a few times. We shorten it. I laugh a lot because in KNF, it's like, oh, we have more acronyms than the Navy SEALs. Everything is acronymized. I don't know if that's a word it is now. So IMO, indigenous microorganism. And what that is you're going out into nature, you're finding areas that are undisturbed. So we're talking, you know, it's not your backyard. Okay. It's not your garden that you've already been cultivating. It's definitely not your compost pile. People really like, look at my IMO from my compost pile. I'm like, that's compost microorganism. It's not indigenous microorganism. It's a whole different thing. And the reason why we want to go out into undisturbed areas is because it has the most biodiversity. So what we're trying to do is capture as much diversity as we can in these collections. We're trying to do it as often as we can from as many different subtle locations. So our farm, I have an oak tree that I love. It's right on the edge of a field. I get great collections from that. But I also want to have a collection underneath the bay tree, which has a different microbiological community living under it. I also want to do under a tan oak, which is again another one. And then we have fir trees, we have maple trees where I live, we have live oak. We have a lot of trees in California. So that means that that diversity under the soil mimics the diversity above the soil. So I have a lot of diversity in my indigenous microorganism collections. Then what I'm doing is I'm taking all of those, I'm inoculating out and culturing a large scale pile that is comprised of carbon and carbohydrates. And what we're doing is we're really trying to peg food for fungi. So we want all of the mushroomy type things, all the mycelium that's running through the forest. I want to say, you should come to my garden. You should come live with my plants. My plants and you guys would get along really well, I think. And it's not there in native soil quite often. It's in our deciduous trees and it's in our old growth forests. Obviously, I'm not going to dig up all the dirt in the old growth forest to move to my farm because then I would be killing my old growth forest and I don't want to do that. So we culture it on a bed of rice. We take that rice. We then have like 10 to 12 of those rice cultures that all have different biology in them. We inoculate it out into this carbon and carbohydrate substrate. And what that does is that's the perfect food for fungi specifically. You also have bacteria, terrestrial yeast. So all that being said, obviously, you know, to increase the soil health that we have on the farm, indigenous microorganisms, or IMO, is our very best friend. So every year, well, or every other year, give or take, what we try to do is make sure that we are adding more of those indigenous microorganisms. This is an ongoing process. Like it doesn't ever stop. So I'm always doing IMO 1, which is that initial collection from the forest. And every year I'm trying to make that into IMO 3, which is many, many IMO 2 collections, which is the stabilized form of IMO 1. And then I'm taking that IMO 3, marrying it with my garden soil and then broadcasting that out. I usually don't go all the way to IMO 5 just because I don't generally have a lot of time. So the compost or the manure that we use will just go kind of on top or again be low tilled in. Now, the one thing that KNF really works well with no-till situations is because you're not tearing apart those fungal hyphae, you're not exposing that microbiology, and therefore you're not having to add it as often. With what we're doing with the low till situation, we know that that first few inches of soil is going to end up being, you know, not so happy. It's going to have biology that's dying back. And that's why we want to add it back with the IMO. So, you know, the great thing about IMO is that you really don't need a lot. You do need a decent amount, but it's not like, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds or anything. I believe that the standard application rate is 3,000 pounds per acre, if I recall correctly. I always have to go to my notes. But in general, where I'm at now is that we just want to every year try and make a 2,000 to 5,000 pound pile, and then just broadcast that out over whatever square footage we're using. You really can't overdo it either, which is a nice thing about IMO 3 and IMO 4, is that it's not like chicken manure where it's hot. So if you put it in there, you might overdo it and kill all your plants. You could literally grow in just IMO 4 if you wanted to. It would be a lot of work, and I don't know that I would necessarily recommend it because you don't have to do that. And again, a part of Korean natural farming is utilizing as little as you can for the most efficacy. So the biggest bang for your buck for the least amount of work, because as a gardener or a farmer, you have a ton of other things that you have to do in any given hour. So if I can do something that has, you know, a percent success rate of, you know, 80%, I want to focus on that one thing. And that for us is indigenous microorganisms. Another benefit that we haven't even touched on yet is pest resistance. So we have plants that will come into us from nurseries and things and from other other sources that will have like aphids or mites of some kind. And for the most part, or thrips is another great one that plants love to, they love to hitchhike in on you and everything that comes to you. And what we found is once we plant them in the garden, like the population will boom for a minute and then it just dies back naturally. We also have access to open air. Like, again, we're outside, not inside. So if you're inside, I don't know that this works quite as well. There's a lot of people that are espousing that if you have a healthy enough plant, it is pest resistant naturally. And while I agree with that to a certain extent, it's kind of impossible to know how healthy your healthy plant has to be. What looks healthy to us might not be truly 100% optimal health. I also know that, like with human beings, the only people that are at optimal health are people that are, you know, A, have the amazing genetics that they have, and B, are extremely high level athletes that are watching their diet and they're exercising and they're being very careful. Most of us are not at that level. I don't think most plants are at that level either. I think that it doesn't really matter how healthy your plant looks to you, there is probably some amount of weakness in it. And so therefore, once pests take hold, especially if you're inside, it's near impossible to get rid of them. If you're outside, again, it's a little different. We don't have this beautiful environment that's all protected and there's no natural predators that can come in. And, you know, the pests just love that. You put thrips in an inside garden and they just, you know, go Richter. You put spider mites in an inside garden or aphids. And if there's no predators in there and there's no wind to knock them down and there's no rain to wash them off, they get to be pretty difficult even in a really, really healthy soil system. So that's why we have IPM, integrated pest management. It's integrated pest management, not integrated pest eradication. So if you're inside, even if you're practicing living soil technique and Korean natural farming, you know, you're going to find less bugs probably, but it's not necessarily going to eradicate them 100%. And you may need to stay on top of some type of preventative maintenance, even if it's just biocontrol. So if you have healthy living soil, it's well mulched and covered, you've got microbiology that's extremely diverse, you've got a really, really healthy plant, you're probably okay with just monthly releases of biocontrol agents. So those would be predators for your pests. So if you notice you have a couple spider mites, you're going to get a predatory mite. If you notice you have a couple aphids, you're going to get some green lacewing larvae. So these are things that you can use inside that can mitigate problems before they become super problematic. Outside, again, I don't really do any of that. We just plant them in the dirt and we allow them to grow for, you know, usually it's somewhere in the 2 to 3 weeks and we'll watch the population just get decimated. And part of that, I think, is that the plants become stronger and healthier. They have access to more nutrients. Their cellular walls get thicker, which makes it harder for sap-sucking insects to pierce them and get into that sap. And then we also have access to the wind and the rain and the natural predators that are there. But again, Korean natural farming has that microbiology diversity. That diversity of soil biology allows those plants to uptake nutrients that are harder to get normally. That allows it for it to be a stronger, healthier plant.
A lot of people, what they'll do is they'll resort to sprays as a preventative. Mm-hmm. Are you doing any type of sprays in order to prevent pests? Or are you like avoiding spraying your plants?
We avoid spraying unless we're foliar feeding. We want to foliar feed our plants. That's something that we do when they are not producing fruits or flowers yet. Once they start producing fruits and flowers, we tend to avoid away from that. Especially our medicinal herb plants, those ones we really don't want once they're in their production stage, we don't want to be spraying anything on them at all. That being said, you know, there is something called JWA or Jadam wetting agent, which is a homemade soap, basically. And we found that it mitigates just about everything. So there's a mite, HRM mites that are out there. Those who know, know. And if you know, you know, it's really, really difficult to combat. We found wonderful success with just JWA, Jadam wetting agent. You have to be on top of it. You've got to do it every third day for 3 weeks is my protocol for that one. And it does have pretty much almost full eradication. And then you have predator insects that you bring in to kind of do the mop up of anybody that you might have missed. But as far as, you know, IPM sprays, it's, if you can avoid it and if you can get plants that are super healthy and happy and not have to do that and just use biocontrol, it is a much better process to go down. But if you are not paying attention and you have a population explosion of pests, you're going to have to use knockback spray. Once they get past the point where you're like, oh, shoot, I have bugs, it's too late. Predator insects are not going to do the job for you. It doesn't matter. I mean, I know people that say that they have done like massive releases of like Californicus or Swirsky, which are different mites, predatory mites, and been able to mitigate pest problems. I myself have tried that and not had that success. I know a lot of other growers that have not had that success and they're expensive. So you've also got a problem of if you did not identify your pest correctly and you did not release the right predator for it, you've now wasted a lot of money on predators that are not specific to that pest. So knockback spray of a simple soap is a really, really good way to go if you have to. But again, ideally, your IPM, your integrated pest management, is that you're managing your pests before they even get there. So you have predators prevalent and ready to fight if they show up. And you have a healthy enough plant that if they show up, they're like, this is maybe too hard. I might hitchhike back out to something that's, you know, easier victims out there in the neighborhood.
Got it. Yeah, if you can avoid those sprays, it can certainly save a ton of time. I mean, I know people who are spraying their plants every single week, religiously, just to prevent, you know, they aren't even battling infestation. But yeah, if you can get to a point where you don't have to spray on a weekly basis, you can save a ton of time doing that. Now, one thing that we didn't get into really that kind of relates to all this is companion planting.
I love my companion plants. So companion planting, so there's two terminologies and they're kind of used loosely and interchangeably, but in my mind, they shouldn't be. So you have a cover crop, which is really meant to cover your soil when you don't have a crop in. So that was the first definition of these was cover crops were put in the fall and it covered the soil so that and a lot of it were winter diebacks. So if you live in a place where it's really cold, you can put a winter rye in and it will grow, it will get nice and big. And then as the freeze comes, it will die back, but it'll turn into its own layer of mulch. It's a really easy way to just, you know, have both mulching and covering at the same time. So, for people like us in California, that doesn't work so well because we don't have killing frost. So things don't die back very well. So that's your cover crop. And then your companion plant is just what it sounds like. It's a plant that is company for your cash crops. So companion plants are amazing. There is a big bee in here. Hello, buddy. Companion plants are amazing for a lot of reasons. One of the things I really love about companion plants is that different plants have different microbial interactions in the soil. So if you have a more increased plant diversity above the soil, you have a more increased microbiological diversity under the soil. That means that if your plant has different communities it likes to hang out with, there's a greater chance of those communities being there and staying alive with other plants being there and alive as well. So, companion plants we've used in the past, we've used food crops. I've used watermelon and cucumber. I do not recommend you use a vine as a companion plant because it can strangle your cash crops. That being said, I tend to break all the rules on my own because I can, I guess, or because I want to see. Some of those have been very, very bad choices, like letting my kids plant birdseed. Wild birdseed turned into millet, which has turned into a 5-year issue. I can't get rid of it. I always miss some. It sets seeds really easily. Also led to me discovering, though, that it makes a really great mulch. So if you can get your millet out there, you can buy bird seed, literally for bird seed. It's very cheap, right? And you can spread it, and you'll generally have millet, possibly some amaranth, and some sunflowers. And all of those are wonderful plants to have in your garden if you can make sure that your millet doesn't take over. Millet has really, really deep roots, so it's really hard to get it out of the ground. It comes back from the crown really easily. It moves through the rhizosphere very easily, so it'll actually send out like roots that will pop up new millet plants. So if you've got a small gardening space, I don't recommend it. But if you have a large gardening space, you might dedicate part of it to just be millet. You can go and cut it down and have your own mulch really easily that way. But again, not your best companion plant either, which was what I originally let my kids do. I was like, yeah, this is your area. Do whatever you want. Well, it's kind of started taking over other areas. So millet, not your best choice for a companion plant, maybe a good choice for a cover crop dependent. But what is good then? So something that grows low, purslane, fabulous, fabulous cover crop companion plant. It will cover your soil. It will last through the winter. It will reseed. It will come back. And it grows, for the most part, fairly low to the soil, up to about 6 to 8 inches. So if you have a cash crop or a herbal medicinal plant that grows very tall, you can easily utilize that. And it's a really easy one. It doesn't take any management whatsoever. It generally likes, it can handle drought tolerant, not super drought tolerant, but it does okay in low water situations. If you do a low till situation, you can literally till it under and it'll come back from its seeds the next year. So it's a fun one. What else have we done? I've tried beets, which didn't turn out very well. There wasn't enough sunlight underneath, so that didn't companion plant well. Marigolds people talk about a lot because they think that it has a natural pyrethrin in it, which is a pest deterrent. But most of the marigolds that people plant are not the ones that actually contain that. And it might not be the pyrethrin, actually, now that I think about it. It might be something else. I don't quite recall. But it's only French marigolds. It's a very specific strain or cultivar of marigold that has that. And I haven't noticed it to necessarily work that well. That being said, I do love marigolds. They're absolutely gorgeous, and I use them as a companion plant every year. I love petunias. What do they do for me? Well, you know, they maybe increase the diversity in the soil because it's a petunia, but nothing really grows. Petunias will take over their area. They're literally so prolific with their foliage and their flowers that they'll take everything that they can, and nothing else can grow underneath them. But they're easy to care for. They're super pretty. I don't know how good of a pollinator they are. I don't usually see my pollinators on my petunias. I usually see them on the dandelions that are right next to the petunias. So as far as a pollinator companion goes, not sure that one's your best bet. We've used lamb's quarter with varying success. Lamb's quarter is a great bioaccumulator. So what it will do is it'll actually take nutrients out of the deep soil and put them up into its leaves and store it. And then you can cut it down and compost it or chop and drop it. And those nutrients will return to the soil and be more available to your cash crops. However, they also grow really tall and they're kind of a pain in the butt. So I don't know that I have mixed feelings about lamb's quarter. I generally forget how much of a pain in the butt it is, and then will allow it to come back 1 year, and then the next few years be like, oh yeah, that was kind of difficult to deal with. So yeah, I think purslane's kind of our big one right now. If you're in a cold area, Dichondra ripens is a wonderful cover crop or companion plant, that doesn't die back in the winter. So it's another one that kind of bridges that gap of companion plant cover crop. Yeah, there's tons. I mean, you can use thymes as companions. If you're growing an herbal medicinal plant that you want to be more prolific in the way that it smells, you can do things like basil, thyme, oregano, rosemary, and these things all have the potential to make your herbal plants more herbaceous and have higher smelling points, higher aromatics. I don't know that there's been a lot of firm research that shows that definitively, but anecdotally, people definitely say that that is something that happens. So yeah, personally, like food crops or crops that have a secondary use are my favorite companion plants. So our purslane we utilize to make fermented plant juice, which is one of our Korean natural farming fertilizer inputs. So for us, it's easy. It takes care of itself. It doesn't require anything. It comes back every year, and I can use it for fertilizer, as well as it protecting the soil and adding to that diversity that we talked about. So if you can find things that are like triple threats like that, right? Singing, dancing, and acting, you've got fertilizer, microbiological diversity, and keeping your soil covered and safe. Like, that's a great companion plant.
Definitely a lot of good information there. I myself have been growing indoors for 12 years, and I've only been growing outdoors since 2018. So that's what, four or five years. And I haven't yet used companion plants. So definitely some of the information is takeaways for me.
On that one note, be careful of what you do use as a companion plant and pay attention to what kind of pests are prevalent on that companion plant. I made the mistake of utilizing white Dutch clover. You hear all, when you start going down this like companion plant cover crop type of rabbit hole, one of the first things you hear about is white Dutch clover.
That's what I use right now.
So my white Dutch clover became a phenomenal banker for thrips. I had thrips that went up and down between my white Dutch clover and my plants that were there, my cash crop plants, up and down and up and down. And I could not get rid of them at all. It was impossible. And because there was that white Dutch clover that was such a preferred food source, and then they would go up and nibble on my cash crop, and then they go back down and hide in the cover or in the companion plant. I couldn't mitigate them at all. I couldn't even manage them because I couldn't spray my cover crop or my companion plant, my clover that was down below. So I ended up having to continually chop that clover down. Clover is great for a lot of things. It makes wonderful biomass, but if it becomes a banker for something like thrips, it becomes an extreme problem because you can't get rid of it. Like, it also will send out runners that become new plants. It self-seeds, so it comes back every year. I've now got it to where it stays in my walkways and gets trampled on. And then if there's a pest problem, it's not spreading to my other plants nearly as much. It is the preferred food source, so they tend to stay in it, so they don't go to my other plants. But especially if you're in an indoor situation, your clover can become a problem with thrips specifically. There's nasturtiums and violas or violets or pansies that all become problems for spider mites. So your spider mites will go in and out of those companion plants and in and out of your foliage back and forth. And they're just having a sweet old time. And, you know, it's not as much of a problem if you have those other plants there because they'll be the primary food source, but you will have some plant resist or plant weakening in your cash crops because they're constantly being kind of nibbled on. Russet mites specifically are very, very host specific. So there are tomato russet mites, they eat tomatoes. There is, you know, hemp russet mite, it eats hemp. There is that's a gall mite, I guess. But most mites, most russet mites are plant specific. They don't tend to go back and forth. And in fact, as far as I know, and I could be wrong there because I know they have been studying a lot, these russet mites in institutions and things now. But as far as I last knew, they were trying to get russet mites to move between hemp and hops, and they were not having good success with that. So they couldn't get them to go back and forth the way that they wanted to, hops being one of the closest plants to hemp. So they were, you know, unable to do that in a educational setting. So out in nature, it might be a little bit different, but as far as it goes with the studies that are being done, they've not had good success. So just kind of have a mindset of like, okay, if I wanted to use columbine, what likes to eat columbine, leaf miners, and thrips? So maybe columbine is not going to be, even though it's a beautiful flower and I love it, I might not want to put that in as a companion with my cash crops. I might want to look at things that are less pests in similarity. Is that a word? Yeah, sure. Less pests similar.
Yeah, definitely some good tips there. I am probably going to stop using white Dutch clover now that you mentioned that. I have a little bit of a bag left, so I won't waste it. I'll still use it. But yeah, that's crazy that thrips feed off it. All right, so we are getting up towards the end of the episode here. You're a wealth of information. This has been fantastic. We covered so much, everything from how you do low-till versus no-till, cover crops, companion plants, mulch layers, some of the KNF inputs that you do, pest prevention, a long list of things we covered in this episode, and I definitely appreciate your time. Tell us, how can the listeners find you, and what do you have upcoming in the future?
So you can find us online at www.sunabis.com. That's sunabis.com. We're also very active on Instagram. Sunabis is our Instagram handle as well. I do a repost thing that posts to, I think, Twitter and my Facebook page, which I think is now Sunabis, but it might be Humboldt's Full Sun Farms. I'm not as active with engagement on those platforms, though. And I feel like I am missing something. You can email me at wendy@sunabis.com if you have a burning question. But again, a direct message through Instagram might be a little bit of a better and quicker bet on that. You can also find us on organiccultivators.net. There's a list of resources there that kind of goes a little bit deeper into some of this stuff. We're working on getting some blogs up on that. And if you want to come and hang out in person, you can find me at the Cowboy Cup in December in Oklahoma. And if you want to hang out for 3 days and get a ton of education, you can come to the Organic Cultivators Supernatural Conference, which will be in Sturbridge, Massachusetts in February.
Fantastic. So lots of good stuff there. If you enjoyed this episode, click that thumbs up button. Also subscribe to the channel if you haven't already. Every single weekend, I'm releasing a new Garden Talk podcast episode, and I'd love for you to tune into future episodes. Wendy, once again, thanks so much for coming on. This has been awesome. I definitely appreciate your time and hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much for having me. I love spreading this message. I love sharing the information and kind of all the trials and tribulations we've gone through. Like I said, I hope this helps people kind of, get through that learning curve a little bit quicker than I may have. And I really encourage people to go out there and plant something, grow something. If you've got a windowsill, you can get a small pot of dirt and you can grow something. And it's really going to be something that changes your life. It's super fun.
Absolutely. All right. Peace out, everyone. Catch you in the next episode.